KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Chris Henson told us from the beginning he was working to bring NBA basketball back to Seattle, and he's kept his word.
For we, the people, understand that our country cannot succeed when a shrinking few do very well and a growing many barely make it.
The fact is, we had four dead Americans. Was it because of a protest, or was it because of guys out for a walk one night who decided they'd go kill some Americans? What difference at this point does it make?
Today on the program, as we review the news of the week, we're going to talk about the Sonics. That was Tim Burgess you heard talking about the Sonics possibly coming back and the deals cut between Chris Hansen and the council and Mayor Mike McGinn. You also heard President Obama from his inauguration speech. And you heard Hillary Clinton, Secretary of State, before Congress, taking umbrage at the questions she was receiving. Eli Sanders is a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist. He writes for The Stranger. He's associate editor. Good to see you again, sir.
Nice to see you.
Joni Balter is assistant political editor for the Pulitzer Prize winning Seattle Times.
Thank you for doing that.
I throw that in there. And C.R. Douglas is a political analyst for the, I'm sure.
We haven't won a Pulitzer yet.
Not a Pulitzer, yeah. But you've won Emmys.
Though. I have won Emmys, yeah.
Emmy award winning journalist and political analyst at Q13 Fox News. Hillary Clinton was laying down some markers there.
Yeah.
Did she acquit herself admirably, or did she leave with some baggage attached?
Well, I had a couple of different thoughts about it. Here's somebody who's been relatively smooth and never loses her cool, and it's sort of her last day, and I just wondered how you're supposed to do the last day. You know, are you supposed to come in and continue that, or do you? In her case, did she feel that this had been politicized enough and she wasn't going to go away quietly and she was going to say what she had to say? What difference does it make? And it seems like she chose the second point there, that she was just going to say that and, you know, think about that. And she's made clear that she needs some downtime after traveling and sort of her illness that happened over the holidays, and that she apparently just felt like speaking her mind. That's what it seemed like to me, because there have been efforts to politicize this. Susan Rice, you know, her deputy there, had taken quite a bit of heat for it, and she's saying, what difference does it make what happened? We're going to investigate this all the way. We're going to go. We're going to find out what happened and sort of stop politicizing this.
Here's a little more in-depth version of that same clip. Here's the longer version.
Again, we were misled that there were supposedly protests and then something sprang out of that, an assault sprang out of that. And that was easily ascertained that was not the fact.
But
and the American people could have known that within days, and they didn't know that.
With all due respect, the fact is we had four dead Americans. Was it because of a protest, or was it because of guys out for a walk one night who decided they'd go kill some Americans? What difference at this point does it make? It is our job to figure out what happened and do everything we can to prevent it from ever happening again, Senator.
That was her exchange with Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson. So, CR, I mean, we all know the talk that Hillary Clinton may be running in 2016. Is this going to continue to trail after? I mean, clearly that's one of the reasons this is being brought up. And perhaps because mistakes were made.
Yeah, I think she is running, actually. And I do think this was kind of a chance for Republicans to kind of knock her down a bit on the last day in an otherwise pretty stellar tenure as Secretary of State. I do think this is the one sort of mark on that tenure. Having said that, I didn't feel like she acted very presidential. I mean, I think Republicans went too far in that, calling for her, you know, she should have been fired and stuff like that. I felt like she was probably exhausted, and that may explain it. I don't think the clip we just heard does her a lot of service. I think she could have made the point and kind of came back at maybe the Republican overreach with a little more diplomacy, if you will. But my guess is in 4 years, if she does run, this will not be a particularly large issue.
Although, you know, the question when she ran before is, can a woman be tough enough to be president? Can she snarl at the other male world leaders when she needs to? And she, I mean, the answer, of course, was obvious to a lot of people then. But for people who are still wondering, I think she answered it a bit in the Senate. And also remember, Hillary Clinton is a veteran of Senate inquiries from her time in the White House with her husband. Obviously, she was in the Senate herself. And I think what she may have been trying to do is make the best of a bad situation. You know, she could just sit there and, you know, meekly let the senators insinuate all kinds of things about her, or she could fight back. I think those were basically her choices, and she chose the latter. And an interesting thing that I don't know what to attribute this to other than maybe that the culture has evolved in the last 10 years, but, you know, the caricature of Hillary for a long time has been of a shrill harpy who, you know, you don't want anywhere around you. And what she did in the Senate was something that could easily be used to ramp up that caricature again. But you didn't see people doing that. Instead, it played as, or at least I didn't see very many people doing that. It played to her credit, at least in the, you know, in the comments that I've been seeing. And there, it didn't end up reconfirming that old caricature. So to me, that also signified a broader change in the culture.
Hmm. Well, I would say that it's very much a double-edged sword. You know, Hillary has been trying, not Hillary and many women in politics, try not to be shrill women yelling. That has a very negative connotation, especially if you're a Republican. And the other thing is, when you see these gatherings many a time, 20 female U.S. senators now is the number. And drill down on that, ask the women, why does it matter if there's women in the Senate versus men? Do they govern differently? What do they do differently? And they always say, women are more collaborative. Women don't need the credit. Women don't blow up. You know, they have these phrases that they use about the differences between men and women. And this is sort of off that script, you know, against that script. I don't know the reason why, you know, it's really about the tone. Those words could have been said if I said, what does it matter? If I said, what does it matter? I mean, there's a difference in sort of just the way you're saying it. And so it is very double-edged. I don't know that the men or just the general audience thought that was a good moment for her.
It felt kind of defensive to me, but I will say I don't think it's a particularly good fight for Republicans. I mean, listen, her approval rating is 67%. It's higher than probably any politician in America. Congressional Republicans are probably at the lowest level of sort of any group in America. So it's not a particularly winning fight for Republicans, this sort of attacking her right now. And I just don't think Benghazi has risen to the level that the public thinks this is some enormous scandal that's being covered up. They tried to make this case. Certainly Mitt Romney did during the election, and it got no traction.
And the left is exasperated by the fact that Republicans keep flogging it. And so in that sense, Hillary Clinton, if she's running for the Democratic nomination, probably did herself a favor in standing up to Republicans on that point. And just to Joni's point, I do hear female senators saying that a lot. And I think, however, that you could see what Hillary Clinton was doing as a sign that she is preparing to run for an executive position, not a, you know, position where you have to get along with a lot of people in a very fractious body, but an executive system, you know.
Yeah, but presidents have to get along with people, too, every now and again.
But what the public consistently wants to see from a presidential candidate is a demonstration at least once or probably at several points along the way to the White House that you can hold your own, that you can take someone down if you need to.
Well, what about the fact that Joe Biden was running in the inaugural, not actual running shoes or anything like that, but that Joe Biden was running to greet the crowd, and his facial expressions in some of those pictures, I literally laughed out loud when I saw those because I think he might be running.
And well, that was my next question.
I think he might be running. If you saw the pictures, AP had a picture, and his mouth is wide open, and he is so gleeful. He is having more darn fun at that inauguration than any other person for 2 or 3 miles around. And so it looks like he's in it. And did everyone see that picture where he was running among the crowd? Not like jogging, but just, I can't get enough of this crowd. It was very funny.
I think he's running. Ouch. I don't want to be Obama and have to sort of decide that endorsement in 4 years. These have been two loyal, loyal foot soldiers for the president. Where does he go when one of these needs an endorsement? I think Joe Biden has the tougher haul. I mean, his approval rating is what? I think 47% or maybe 50. And Hillary's, again, as I said, is really high. I mean, I think at this point, the nomination is hers if she wants it. But, you know, having said that, we are light years away from that.
And just one point, the highest rated politician, she's not really a politician, in Washington is Michelle Obama. She's in the 70s.
Wow. For what this is worth, we did an early slog poll the other just a head-to-head Biden versus Clinton. And Clinton overwhelmingly won among our readers. But then the next day, because of some comments that were brought up in that post, we did Clinton head-to-head with Warren, because it turned out a lot of our readers were thinking, hey, Elizabeth Warren, she could do what Obama did, one term in the Senate.
Warren, liberal senator from Massachusetts.
And that, interestingly, was a lot closer, although Hillary, I think the last I checked, was still a bit ahead. One interesting thing about the Clinton-Obama choice, and maybe you can get the firm answer to this, but they'll both be quite old, at least relative to other presidential candidates in years past.
Biden will be 74.
Biden especially.
Will be what?
I think she'll be 69.
Yeah,
she's a bit younger, but yes, they are both.
Yeah.
So age is going to be an issue.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that plays, or if it plays.
One just quick thing on this. When we talk about Bill Clinton's role in this last election, which was huge, and I think. Decisive. Listen, he wanted this guy to win. He's a Democrat. He's now loyal to sort of Obama. But I don't think you can discount the fact that he needed Obama to win if Hillary has a chance in 2016. I think that was part of the motivation. Two reasons for that. One is, if Obama didn't get a second term, well, Obama is sort of still theoretically a candidate in 2016. You got to get Obama off the stage. And the only way to do that in 2016 is to get him reelected. And the second thing is, I think most people feel like the economy is troughed. It's coming back. It probably doesn't even matter what tax rates are for the highest 2% or whatever. I mean, you can tinker with these things, but I think housing's coming back, the economy's coming back, and whoever was going to be in office, whatever party was in office for these next 4 years, is probably going to get the most credit for the economy coming back. And in this case, because Democrats have won, I think the Democrat will sort of be teed up as sort of overseeing, you know, the party that saw the recovery. If Republicans had won, I think they would have gotten credit for that. So two reasons why Bill was so involved in this campaign, I believe, other than just, you know, a genuine, sincere interest in wanting to.
And also, if there was a turning point in the momentum of the presidential race, there were a couple. But one of them was clearly the night Bill Clinton spoke at the convention. And you could tell they both thought it. Remember, they bowed to one another up there on the stage. Does anybody remember this minute? Mm-hmm. And it was almost like, hey, guys, we nailed it. We got it. And so that there's a debt there, as you're saying. There's a debt of Obama to Bill Clinton. There's no maybe. There's probably a debt of Obama to Joe Biden, who's been
probably an ongoing debt.
Ongoing debt, but yeah.
These negotiations.
And you can be almost certain that Clinton is keeping a ledger of that. There's a really funny Maureen Dowd column a while back where she talked about, she wasn't making this up, apparently, Bill Clinton had wandered around during the 2008 presidential race when he was really miffed about how Hillary Clinton was being treated by Obama. He thought it was too harsh. He kept a list of something like, you know, 69 or 169 slights that Obama had committed against Hillary.
Wow.
He was going to, you know, get payback for. So he's a guy who keeps a ledger of this kind of stuff.
Do not get on Bill Clinton's bad side.
And he shows up at the Golden Globes, you know, just unannounced like that. Just you never know where he's going to pop up.
Joni Balter, Eli Sanders, and C.R. Douglas are reviewing the news of the week with us on weekday. We're going to take a break, and then we'll come back, talk more national and local stuff as well.
-47 degrees and mostly cloudy in Seattle. Forecast says expect clouds through the rest of the day. Chance of showers. High temperature, 46. That's where we are right now.
President Obama's second inauguration was good, but it wasn't as great as the first one. The president himself seemed surprised, especially when he tried to replicate his great 2009 crowd surf and instead just landed in Justice Scalia's lap. I'm Peter Sagal. Join us for the other solemn ceremony of democracy. That would be Wait, Wait, the news quiz from NPR.
Tomorrow morning, 10 o'clock, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from PCC Natural Markets. PCC embraces the winter season with organic Rio Star grapefruit, fresh winter greens, and hearty soups with 9 neighborhood locations. More at pccnaturalmarkets.com.
I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 10:20.
We are reviewing the news of the week with, now I'm going to give Twitter handles, with at Eli J. Sanders.
That's right.
At Joni Balter.
At J. Balter.
At J. Balter. At J. Balter.
Mm-hmm.
And the longest, or second longest, perhaps, at CR Douglas Q13 Fox.
And that leaves his tweets at 70 characters, not 140.
You know, it was interesting to hear Seth Meyers talking about both using Twitter to tell jokes and, more importantly, I thought, which was interesting, using Twitter to find good comedians, because it turns out that 140 characters is just the right amount of a length
to be funny
for a good joke.
Oh, wow.
So given that, is there a news haiku? Is there a news rubric for Twitter?
Well, not for characters, but I would say that Twitter is it's so interesting how, you know, they'll set off a Twitter fest with one personal tweet and then everyone will get in on it. And I do think that Twitter is affecting the news. I see it. I see how sometimes reporters will tweet something out first before they even file like a blog or a story. There's certainly a debate about that, whether that's the best use of your staff. I've talked to some people on TV. They have requirements. They have thresholds they have to hit every day for tweets. Is that,
really?
Is it true, CR? Tell the truth.
There's an expectation, although it's not a quota.
That was too long for a tweet.
At least at our station, yeah.
Expectation for at least one.
Yeah, yeah.
So essentially, expectation that you are making some news.
Correct, and that we're, you know, we all have a story we're working on a day. So they want a sort of tweet, you know,
energy
reference
level
to the
right
story we're working on that day.
So we, as consumers, should be using the Twitter in the way we used to use like the AP Newswire.
Right, like you're sitting in those rooms listening to those noisy machines. This is another way of sort of getting a little bit of a heads up that something's coming.
But I would say as you go from sort of, you know, most kind of concrete sourced to kind of a little more casual to sort of a little more rumor, I mean, you know, tweet is in the farthest sort of spectrum on the side of rumor. So you can get kind of a conversational, oh, I heard this, you know, not sure it's true. You know, there's
yeah, but
you wouldn't do that on the front page of the Seattle Times. I wouldn't do that in my nightly news story, you know, at Q13. But so you got to be careful. I mean, there have been tweets that have been sort of
wrong.
Trouble. I think this is the future, you know, a topic for journalism ethics. Because do you get to tweet something just because it's a tweet and say, oh, well, it was just a tweet. I didn't check that out. I didn't have time to make a phone call or something. I mean, come on. It can be quite reckless.
And there's a way in which it then migrates very quickly into the media stream, like with Newtown. I think we saw this there, where a reporter from a respected news organization tweets something that's maybe not solidly verified, and then another news organization uses that as the source for, you know, a tweet that sounds a little more certain, and it just kind of grows like a game of telephone into a certainty when it wasn't and no one's actually checked it. So I agree with CR. You have to be very, very cautious about the truth of what you're reading on Twitter, even from journalists, unfortunately. It's very good, however, at these kind of first drafts, and also at helping journalists cover live events and you know, getting information out to the hardcore news junkies who are interested in that information right now, the live coverage of a school board meeting, for example, and then using those tweets as a rough draft for the first draft of a more fully checked story that then goes out.
Well, not even news people. I mean, as consumers, as we we want to check a live event from you know, the inauguration to a school board, we can do that.
Mm-hmm. But also think about what happens when somebody very quickly retweets something that is very interesting to them. They don't know it to be true, but they retweet it out of Q13 or the Seattle Times. They're putting their stamp on it without having done much. Retweet. But you don't know it yet. So I think this is just a really interesting area for discussion.
I also tend to think it's a bit of a very, very small universe. I mean, our news researcher shows that, you know, I mean, by far, you know, we're talking about like the Q13 brand. Well, far and away, it is consumed over the air. I mean, that's how our people get it. It's typical of a news station. Probably next is our website. Then we sort of, you know, down the road quite a bit. Distant third is sort of Facebook, and we're all kind of doing Facebook. And it's a very, very small percentage of people that are sort of in this tweet universe.
The Twitterverse. Yeah. All right, so I'll climb out of the Twitterverse here. Let me ask you about just two quick things, and then we'll look locally. Because we were talking about women and attitudes and the change that Eli was talking about.
Yeah.
It's a big week.
It was a big week. Because, women in combat.
Yeah, women in combat.
Yeah. I read the New York Times had a very good piece on that this morning, if you saw it. And it was featurey and all that, but it captured the notion that women have been in the terribly wrong places at the wrong time, and they've done heroic things. But the woman who was featured in this piece was not there in the capacity to do the heroic things. She was a photographer, or they were technicians, but they weren't in these positions. But they've been doing the heavy lifting, some of them, anyway. And so just another step, I imagine, on the road to equality is what the...
Of course, the heavy lifting is going to be the question. I heard the hedging that we heard some service leaders saying, well, we don't know if women can be in Navy SEALs or they can be Green Berets. That seems like the last barriers of bias to fall. What do you think?
Yeah,
I know none of
us. You, and I think
in the service right now, and service members will have a different idea. But I'm curious.
I think we'll find out. I mean, we've seen before so many things that people said, "Oh, that just will not work in the military." Gays in the military, now women in combat, and I think, you know, those last walls probably will fall, or people will figure out what the actual sensible barriers should be. Just to circle back to Hillary, I was thinking when you were setting this up that what we saw in her testimony was a woman in political combat.
Oh.
And the kind of shrugging response to it, at least that I perceived, is similar to the shrugging response that followed the announcement that women are allowed to serve in actual combat in the military. I mean, it just was not, you know, the highest setting on the culture war furnace that we've seen in the past. So that was progress.
I like the image of the culture war furnace.
Thanks.
We're heating it up.
Well, you mentioned the Navy SEALs. What about the story of Zero Dark 30? There's a woman featured rather prominently in just, you know, never giving up, always pursuing Osama bin Laden. And I actually didn't know that story until I saw the movie. And I'm sure it's a little movie-ized, I get that. But just the idea that the Navy SEALs went in, there were no women in that group, obviously, in that movie. But she was the one who came up with the whole thing.
Well, you know, you talk about the senators say, oh, women, people say, oh, women in politics will be more collaborative, they'll work closer together. Women in combat. I mean, is it really going to be any difference once we've achieved...
Well, what I mentioned earlier is a line that you get often if you call up the Center for the American Women in Politics at Rutgers University. They always talk about this. Interview Patty Murray any day of the week, and she'll say, you know, women are more collaborative. We work together. We don't need all the credit. We do the heavy work. I mean, you know, that like that. But I just think it's an ongoing discussion about that.
Did you folks learn anything from President Obama's inauguration? Do you have a sense of what kind of second term we'll get? Is he going to be more combative and less collaborative?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I think it was a good speech. I think he kind of set the stage for what he wants to do in the second term, be that immigration, which I think has got support, an indirect but clear reference to sort of gun control, which I think has support. He talked about climate change. I think that has got support. So he's going to be feistier. He kind of went for it more than typically happens in an inauguration speech. I thought the shortcoming, and I think it's large, is that there was really no reference to what I think is the biggest elephant in the room, which is the budget and what has consumed national politics for most of his term, certainly the last 2 years, which is the standoff over sort of taxation and spending. I mean, it is what is going to define most of the next term for him. And there was no reference to that. And I thought that was a shortcoming. I mean, he has talked about a balanced approach to this. I think that's the right thing. But he got part of that balance when he got taxes increased after the election. And I think not having sort of dealt with the sort of balance, the other side of the balance, kind of the spending side and the entitlement programs, I think he didn't do himself any service by not setting the stage for some sacrifice that I think is going to be required if he wants to make headway.
But an inauguration speech is different than a State of the Union speech, isn't it? I mean, aren't you shooting for a higher level of vision?
You typically don't have policy pronouncements, that's true. So you don't have your sort of point-by-point plan. But listen, you lay out your agenda, and he was not shy about mentioning climate change. He was not shy about mentioning immigration. And I think making some reference to what everyone there was thinking, which is this standoff that we have had, felt like it didn't do the country a service to not say where he's going on that.
Here, let's just a little taste of President Obama's inauguration speech.
We must be a source of hope to the poor, the sick, the marginalized, the victims of prejudice. Not out of mere charity, but because peace in our time requires the constant advance of those principles that our common creed describes. Tolerance and opportunity. Human dignity. And justice.
That is one very happily reelected president talking there. And he just sort of can't control himself. Like, you know, I thought he addressed the standoff in a way by saying, my first term, I wanted to be reelected. I wanted to be postpartisan. I wanted to be the guy that could work with you. Well, that didn't work. So let's try this other thing where I come out screaming for what I want to occur. It did have some of the listing of agendas that a State of the Union has. I should point out the State of the Union is on Lincoln's birthday, February 12th. I'm just saying. But he went through the issues, and they were liberal issues, climate change, gay marriage, gun control. And he didn't apologize. He was like, okay, I tried working with you guys. That wasn't so hot. I'm going to tell you what I'm aiming for, knowing he's not going to get many of the things that he's asking for. Republicans, if you talk to them, were just really unhappy with him because he really did let it all hang out. He really did. And they felt that they weren't included. And so we'll see how that works. Hmm.
But they would have been unhappy with him anyway. And the previous stance, as Joni mentioned, you know, trying to meet them halfway before they've even ventured in any direction just led to them taking advantage of his willingness to compromise. So I agree with what Joni is saying. I think what you saw was a president who was going to come out, you know, with a full-throated defense of where he stands ideologically and a vision for where he wants to go. I think that inaugural addresses tend to be more aspirational and foundational. Here is fundamentally where I stand and where I think we should be going. And then, as you pointed out, the State of the Union address will bring forward more detailed policy proposals on how we get there. I think I would come back to what I said when we were discussing Jay Inslee's inaugural last week, which is, you know, inaugurals are nice, they're interesting to listen to, but you watch what they do and not what they say. And so the State of the Union will be a little more interesting on that score, but then actually what is introduced by the president in Congress and where it goes will be the most interesting.
I was just going to add to that, though, that the Republicans have already said they don't want the immediate fight over the debt ceiling. They punted that, kicked that little can down the road a little bit. And maybe it's because the constant arguing is not a winning formula for either side. But if they look to be like, oh, every time we get a chance to have a fight, we take the fight, it's better to or they seem to think it's better to take a break here.
I don't think he likes giving these kinds of speeches anymore. I mean, the inauguration speech, as it's been pointed out, is more of a majestic, it's sort of a kind of grand vision. It's, you know, your kind of obligatory reference to the Declaration of Independence, you know, and your Constitution. You had a lot of we the peoples here. You know, it was about, you know, we're great and we're going to kind of come together and meet the challenges of the day. He doesn't like those speeches anymore. I mean, the speech he gave that sort of most typified that was that 2004 keynote speech at the Democratic Convention, where he talked about, you know, we are one. There is no liberal America. There is no conservative America. There is the United States of America. Well, that is not where he is at anymore. He would never say that again. And it is not true. There is a liberal America. There is a conservative America. So the inauguration forces you. It is a speech about the country, not a speech about your party or a sort of a partisan kind of, you know, bell ringer. You got to kind of meet everyone there. And I don't think he likes these anymore. I think he'd much rather give a sort of Democratic nomination speech. He wants to be like he was at the press conference a few days before that. You know, Republicans have been the problem. They're the stumbling block. You know, it's a hard place to do that. And I think this is his last time he'll ever try to be highfalutin for the next 4 years.
Yeah, but there's sort of no evidence that he doesn't like speeches in general. And I'm not saying that you're saying that because, you know, he was known for soaring rhetoric that always sort of brought everybody.
Sometimes.
Well, except for that debate.
But it hasn't worked. And he's not giving these speeches anymore.
I'd like to say
he
had to with the inauguration in some way.
What about the speech that he gave after Newtown? He was.
But those are different, aren't they? Isn't that a different moment?
It depends on how you use it.
Moment
it depends on how you use it. And he used it to say, we will do gun control.
Well, that's true. Yeah. I just like the idea. Go ahead.
What was so stirring about that speech was the really delicate way in which he twined a kind of roll up your sleeves call to action with the requirements of that moment, which was mourning and acknowledgement of what was lost. That is a very hard thing to do rhetorically, and in a moment when the death is still so fresh in everyone's memory. And similarly, I thought, like CR said, I did detect a note of exasperation in President Obama's inaugural, or just a general kind of vibe of exasperation from him over the past months or maybe year, which I think reflects reflects the general American exasperation with what's not getting done in D.C. And so he used the inaugural again to give a kind of roll up your sleeves message rather than an inspirational message. He's saying, let's get something done. I want to do that rather than give inspirational speeches.
Well, let me ask you something and just a reaction. So John Cassidy in The New Yorker was writing about the inauguration. On the left and right, the consensus appears to be that Obama is now backing away from any serious entitlement reforms. He's content to lock in some modest deficit reduction in other areas and let his successors deal with the Medicare time bomb. It sounds like you heard something different than that.
No, I believe that's right. When I say I don't think he talked about that in his speech or has really even in other times given a clear indication of what he means by a balanced approach, other than it's clear what he wants on one side of the balance, higher tax rates and that kind of stuff. But he has not been clear about what he wants on sort of the other side of the balance in terms of spending cuts. And I read that article, too. I don't know if it's that he feels like that's not his fight and he's just going to sort of let those be where they are and then deal with gun control and climate change and sort of leave entitlement reform to the next person. I don't think that tees up the Democrat in 2016 very well. I mean, unless there's some sense of spending, you know, constraint and some sense of deficits getting under control, I think he doesn't do his successor, whoever the party is, any service.
I'm not certain about that. I think he maybe tees up the Democrat for a finish the job kind of argument, and he can make some modest steps toward that goal in, you know, this term and hopefully clearly show how he was obstructed in, you know, his attempt to get that done. And we need more Democrats in Congress and, you know, a Democrat in the White House to get it done. I think that would be the argument from the left. And obviously from the right, you can't get it done. We need change.
Well, he's not going to have sorry, just to jump in there. He doesn't have any problem with Republicans on entitlement reform. He has problems with his own party. And you know, he's asking for a lot of hard votes here on these agendas. He's asking for hard votes from sort of both parties on gun control. He's asking for hard votes from Republicans on immigration. He's asking for, you know, hard votes for Republicans on climate change and kind
and
of
Democrats.
And Democrats. But Democrats, especially on entitlement reform, I mean, you know, he needs to get sort of get some movement from his own party. And that's the sort of sacrifice message that he hasn't really given.
There was a sentence in this speech that I've seen quoted almost in all the articles that were takedowns, shakedowns of what he said. And it was this thing that these programs that we're all arguing about, they don't weaken us, he said. They strengthen us. And that was, that's right back at you, isn't it? Where he's saying, I'm not going to apologize for these programs. Yeah, they need some trims and snips and this kind of stuff. But, you know, he's this is about the 47%, you know, not a nation of takers, but a nation who benefit once they get these kinds of programs.
Speaking of takedowns, there's a really great John Stewart takedown of Paul Ryan's takers and makers argument in relation to Obama's speech. He kind of put them into argument with each other visually and then pointed out that Ryan himself, his story actually proves what Obama was saying. He relied on government assistance at a very hard point in his life, and it didn't make him into a, you know,
hammock layer.
Yeah, into a hammock layer with no will of his own. It clearly, he came out better for it.
He got his father had died, is the story, and they got some benefits for
disability, right?
Disability benefits for the family. And so that was one of those.
On the kicking the can down the road point, I just wanted to circle back to that quickly. You could forgive Obama, I think, for the impulse to perhaps do that with some of these bigger issues, just in the sense that he is someone who got some of the heaviest cans kicked in his direction of any president in recent memory. You know, the wars, the economy in a tailspin. I mean, you could forgive him saying, I'm gonna kick some things into my successors.
Big number 10 cans with tomato sauce.
Kick the can down the road Olympics. Yeah. That's what's coming next.
All right, we're going to take a break. We're going to come back. We're going to hear the sound of the day and talk local politics.
-47 degrees and mostly cloudy in Seattle.
KUOW and Thalia's Umbrella present A Day in the Death of Joe Egg by Peter Nichols, a dark comedy about love, marriage, and a kid in a wheelchair. January 31st through February 17th at ACT Theater. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
Every Saturday night, The Swing Years and Beyond takes you on a tour of popular music from the 1920s through the 1950s. I'm Amanda Wilde. Join me for The Swing Years and Beyond, Saturday nights, starting at 7 o'clock on 94.9 KUOW.
Support for KUOW comes from the Seattle Boat Show, with more than 1,000 boats on display January 25th through February 3rd at CenturyLink Field and South Lake Union, with a shuttle between locations. Tickets online at seattleboatshow.com.
It's 10:43. A former CIA officer has been sentenced to more than 2 years in prison for leaking a covert officer's name to a reporter. The judge says she would have given him much more time in prison if she could have. We'll have more on that in 20 minutes. KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
And now.
This is the sound of the week. The sound of the week.
What is that? Everybody's asking that. What is that sound? Usually the sound ends the hour previously, but we talked a little long with Rob McKenna. So I wanted to play it. I think you guys need this. You'll like it. This is going to fit right in. That's the sound of a territorial male mormyrid fish signaling aggressively to another fish. They use weak electrical signals with an electric organ in their tail. This is what politicians need. And they use it to electrolocate objects, and they communicate with others.
It's easy for you to say.
Yeah. It's too bad you don't still have a comedian on.
This is how Rob McKenna and Jay Inslee sound when they approach each other.
Or not.
Wow. Weekday listener Dr. Matthew Arnegard recorded the sound during a rainy breeding season in the rainforest of Gabon in west central Africa. The fish lives in a tangled root mass of a floodplain, the trees along the banks of a forest stream, and he says there were footprints of forest elephants all around the site of the recording. And we have a link to the fish and a little video weekday on KUOW. Wow, that's a cool sound.
Yeah.
Send us more sounds of your lives. And if you can get to Gabon and get an electric fish or get the recorder between Jay Inslee and Rob McKenna, you'll hear that same sound.
Same diff.
Let's talk a little bit about Rob McKenna and Jay Inslee and what's happening and in the legislature. And first of all, Rob McKenna, you talked to him. We talked to him
just now.
Yeah,
I spent some time with him, and you did too as well. So you see
What and then the Republicans at this point are meeting, trying to understand who's going
to
be the Republican Party that will be here. And, as Robin kind of said, runs the risk of being a regional party unless they figure out how to talk to a broader audience and have a wider tent.
But what he said to me was that this is where the tension is on that. That Republicans, if you look at the issues and the voting in 2012, that they need to be more libertarian in their approach to these issues. Yet, if they are libertarian in their approach, they risk losing the base. And this has been the tension, the back and forth, a challenge for a candidate just like him. You know, how to make that work. So he's very philosophical about what comes next for the Republicans. He himself, I'm sure he told your listeners, is going to one of six law firms and hoping to practice regulatory law, digital privacy, that sort of stuff.
And
I bet the most interesting
and also be
thing,
sort of a face, still a face of the Republican
Party.
He's
not going away.
Yeah.
No. The most interesting thing in my interview was about his wife, Marilyn, who has become quite the tweet.
Yeah, speaking of Twitter.
She did some wild tweeting before, during, and after the election, and he just chuckled about that because she has some strong opinions that are different.
Yeah,
in some
different
cases
than his, yeah.
From his.
More progressive.
Does the Republican Party manage to be a successful party if they just move to a more libertarian sense of things? I mean, is that enough?
Well, Bob Moore did a poll that was released yesterday, I think, and it talked about, interviewed Washington voters, I forget how many, but the question was, what is it you don't like, or how do we get a governor elected after this long drought? And the answer was that the image of the Republican brand as being more favorable to big business and the rich was more troublesome for Republican candidates than their positions on social issues by some percentage difference.
How do you be a Republican and not seem like you're in support of the rich? Eli.
How many ideas do you want me to
how
list
How many
here?
Gimmies?
But I would say, the Republican Party in the state is not usually in favor of taking advice from the stranger. But I think...
Well, perhaps this is the door opening they need.
Oh, this is it.
Kirby Wilbur is calling you up.
You want a couple things. One, they could do meaningful gun control in the state legislature, which a poll just recently showed a majority of Washingtonians want. But because of this Republican and Rodney Tom-enabled coup, we have an NRA A-plus rated Republican installed in the relevant committee in the Senate who will block any meaningful gun control, which ties right back to big business, right? Guns are a huge industry. So if they are sitting around scratching their heads about why there is the perception out there that they are the handmaidens of big business, well, there's just one easy example.
But, of course, a Republican would argue it's not about business. It's about liberty.
Well, they would, but that argument's not working. And that's why they're out there asking pollsters to tell them what's wrong.
I do think, in terms of locally, the Republican brand, it's a very blue state. And it is a green state. And Jay Inslee made quite a bit during this campaign of sort of climate change, green energy, the environment. And that is a very, very popular winning issue in Washington. And the Democrats kind of own that green space, if you will. And I think Republicans, if they need, want to sort of get back into the game at the gubernatorial level, need to show some sort of environmental credentials.
And mainstream Republicans have long had that. If you go back to some
Dan Evans and others,
William Ruckelshaus,
absolutely.
Ralph Monroe, but they've lost those issues. They absolutely did.
Yeah. How's Jay Inslee doing?
I think he's doing quite well. He's sort of, what, maybe just a week into it, maybe 10 days, something like that. I've been down to Olympia a number of times, covered at least two press conferences, was at the inauguration, all kinds of things. So, I mean, I covered him during the campaign, as we all did. I've seen him up close quite a bit in the last week as he's been governor. And I must say, there is a stature that sort of anyone kind of gets the minute they get this office. But I would say with him, there's been quite a stature quotient. I mean, there was all kinds of sort of griping on the campaign, especially among Democrats, that he sort of wasn't up to it, that he didn't really kind of spit out the issues well, wasn't nearly as well kind of versed on stuff as Rob McKenna, didn't probably do as well in debates if you just sort of go point by point up against that Republican. But seeing him in office, he's got a handle on it. He seems refreshed. He's ready. I mean, a reporter yesterday at the news conference asked some question about a court decision, not McCleary, but another one. And I turned to another reporter. Most of the reporters didn't know what the question was about. And Jay was right there. And it was the kind of thing that, like, wow, on the campaign trail, he wasn't sort of, as quick with stuff. And he does seem that now. And I think he's really coming into his own.
One take on sort of what happened during the campaign came from John Carlson, you know, who's active in the Republican Party and works for KVI. And I had him in.
Ran for governor.
He doesn't like to talk about that one. He didn't do too well. But he had a very funny observation about Jay Inslee. He came to this class I was doing, and the students were asking, you know, what happened? Why did Jay Inslee win? What happened? And he said, I am convinced in another lifetime that Jay Inslee was a black Labrador. And and the reason that is funny is because even like the reason I laughed, I think, is because I remember during some of the debates, you know, McKenna would probably have the stronger, more coherent argument, but Jay was up there smiling and having the best time. So to go to the black Labrador, it's sort of like, even if it wasn't a good experience for him, he's still sort of wagging his tail and licking everybody, you know, just like, just such a happy puppy.
Well, I agree in part with that. Image counts, obviously, in political campaigns, and we talk
you
about
see Jay Inslee as a black Labrador.
I don't know if I'd go there, but we did talk about when the first commercials came out for the gubernatorial candidates that McKenna's first commercial in particular was awful, and I think his own campaign acknowledged that, and Inslee was always, you know, in great light, hard hat on, work shirt if it, you know, the occasion called for it, just looking good. And for the people who make their decision, you know, with the TV on mute and a commercial running in the background of their dinner late at night,
so it's all about mute,
episodes,
huh?
Of Law and Order, that works. And unfortunately, sadly, I don't advocate for this, but sadly, that is how a lot of decisions get made. And Inslee was smart, and his campaign managers were smart.
Sure. He's got to wash in the idea that our government is decided by images where people are putting the TV on mute. I know you're right.
One thing that's interesting, I mean, what has dominated actually his first week or so has been pot. I mean, the two press conferences he's given, we've all asked him about it. He spent a lot of time talking about it. This is a guy that didn't like the pot initiative. I mean, voted against it. But now that it is law, by 56%, I mean, overwhelming, he's going for it. I mean, he has been back there talking to Attorney General Holder. He is trying to make this regime such, meaning the sort of state sponsor production, distribution, and sale of this, such the feds are not going to intervene. It's not enough to just sort of legalize and let it go. I mean, the feds probably will shut you down. I mean, what is important here is to get it right in a way that the feds are comfortable. So how do you prevent leakage? How do you make sure you got a system where, you know, the growers, you know, when they sort of truck it and give it to the distributors, that, you know, half of that isn't going to California. I mean, he's got this plan where he's going to sort of digitally track this stuff. He is jumping on this issue. He's passionate about making marijuana legalization work, and the rules and the regime you create are important, and this is the year to sort of do those before sales start. And I think he really sees this as as an important thing to get right, and also politically an absolute winner. I mean, if he gets this right, marijuana legalization, you know, is sort of unobstructed by the feds, he wins. And if he goes and at some point they shut him down, I think he's the martyr, the green martyr, and the state will still love him.
And a martyr among independents. We talked about this during the election and hammered on it afterward. Inslee shot himself in the foot, I think, among independents who he had a problem with his stance on pot. They were way ahead of him political evolution-wise in their support of marijuana legalization, and I think or hope he's realized that was a mistake and wants to get around on the other side of it when he runs for re-election.
Well, don't forget, a couple of weeks ago, I think it was, President Obama was asked about the pot legalization in Colorado and Washington State. And, you know, pushed, he said, you know, I do have bigger fish to fry. In other words, from the top dog here, since I'm all about the dogs today, but from the top dog here, he's saying...
What is President Obama?
I don't know.
I think top dog is pretty good.
Okay, top dog will work for this particular
person. No one's topper than him in the dog chain.
So the overarching policy is bigger fish to fry. So now they're into the details. And Jay Inslee and Bob Ferguson, the new attorney general, were back in D.C. probably for the inauguration, something like that. And so they went to see Holder. And the main thing, as you mentioned, seemed to be, well, if Washington's going to do this and it's so far and we don't worry about it, just don't send that pot to Idaho and you know, Oregon and California. Just find some way to keep it.
He really wants to get this right. And, oh, by the way, there's a lot of money at stake. I mean, mm-hmm. you could fulfill a lot of Supreme Court mandates with pot money without raising taxes. So that's a side benefit, a direct benefit, not even side benefit, of getting this right and allowing this to go forward without the Fed stopping you.
Did you see that that Rodney Toms said that he would not factor in? There is money for the state in this, obviously, that he would not factor in, I don't know, is it $300 or $400 million into the budget planning until he knew that there was an agreement with the federal government?
And I think that's fair. And I don't think, I mean, yeah. Jay's budget's not going to come out with assuming marijuana legalization until they do get the green light from the feds.
I want to hit two things real quick. And one of them is he breaking his promise if he extends a tax that was going to, two taxes that were going to expire? I mean, is he going to do that? You know, is it a non-starter for him? Does he look like Mike Lowry or... does he do that? One was a B&O tax. I forget what the other one
was. The other one was a beer tax, I'm pretty sure.
That's right.
And I think that gets into this whole fight that is with Tim Iman. Is extending a tax that was supposed to expire the same thing as increasing a tax? This is like so philosophical. We could spend like hours.
Well, it's political. I mean, will he do it? I'm just wondering if he'll do it.
I think he will do it. My sense is that the budget hole is big enough, especially with the Supreme Court decision to fund, you know, education by $1 billion the next year or two, and then even more than that over time, that this raises, if you extend these taxes, something like $200-300 million. I mean, it's money they need to fill this hole. I think they see it that way, Democrats. And he was very clear in that press conference that he does not see that as breaking his pledge. He's not advocating it today, but it would not be breaking his pledge to not raise taxes to extend a tax that is set to expire.
He was clearly testing it to see if it should go in the budget, right? Wasn't that just like a test? Hey, what do y'all think of this?
Yeah.
He was just sending the green light to legislators. If you feel like you need this, I'm not going to stop you. This should be part of the negotiation.
And then, Eli, real quick, we talked about GET earlier with Rodney Tom, and you mentioned GET. And he talks about wanting to kill it. He has arguments for why he wants to end GET. What's going on here? Is this about getting money to higher ed and not having to take it out of the state budget?
I don't understand it, actually, because it makes no sense on its face. There was an editorial in the Seattle Times that kind of made the same argument as Rodney Tom. And when you got to the bottom of the editorial, you saw the fine print that Tom doesn't acknowledge very much, which is that it will cost more to end GET than it will to fully fund it over the next few years.
But it frees the colleges up to raise their tuition even more.
And that's a good idea? I mean, that's what perplexes me about this. Rodney Tom, I believe, who went to the UW, by the way, as David Goldstein pointed out on our blog, and benefited from their low tuition a while back and now lives in a mansion in Medina and wants to endlessly raise tuition for the state's students. Rodney Tom, you would think, would want to lower tuition. And so it just doesn't make sense to me.
No, neither of you have time to respond.
Oh,
I'm sorry.
We have to end the show there.
We'll do it again. Joni Balter is assistant political editor of the Seattle Times. Eli Sanders is associate editor of The Stranger. C.R. Douglas is political analyst, Q13 Fox. Bernard Ouellette is our engineer. Weekdays produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, Amin Alsaadeh. Help from Andy Hurst as well. You guys have an excellent weekend.
You too.
And to you too.
And
yep.
We will talk to you folks again on Monday.
#10:59 Georgia Senator Saxby Chambliss, Republican, says he's frustrated with Washington gridlock, and because of that, he will not seek re-election next year. More in the news in a minute. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Did you know you can support KUOW through a planned gift? A planned gift to KUOW helps ensure that public radio remains available in our community for years to come. For information on how you can make a planned gift while receiving financial benefits today, go to kuow.org/support-future.
There's a new assault weapons ban to consider. That's a phrase a lot of gun owners don't care for, much less how they're described.
Gun people aren't oblivious to things. You know, we're not these Neanderthals. You know, just.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.